Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Jim, we begin with a story that broke just after we finished recording. We recorded a little bit early on Monday, and shortly thereafter, we got the news from New York City that former Congressman, the disgraced Anthony Weiner, has in fact been sentenced to prison for exchanging lewd information with an underage girl. Here is a bit of the New York Times story. He lost his seat in Congress, his audacious bid to resurrect his career as mayor of New York City, and his high-profile marriage, and he undermined Hillary Clinton's shot at the presidency in the closing days of the tumultuous 2016 campaign. On Monday, Anthony D. Weiner, sobbing as the judge spoke, learned the final personal cost of his unseemingly uncontrollable habit of exchanging lewd texts and pictures with women and girls, 21 months in prison. Until now, he was the beneficiary of multiple second chances amid earnest vows that he had learned his lesson. But this time, there would be no second chance for Mr. Weiner, who pleaded guilty in May to one count of transferring obscene material to a minor and had faced up to 10 years in prison. His texting habit fueled his long and tortuous downfall, but it was his most recent exchanges with a 15-year-old girl that were the most personally ruinous. His wife filed for divorce, he pleaded guilty, and now faces imprisonment. As you can tell, Jim, according to the New York Times, Anthony Weiner apparently is the victim here. The judge, Denise Coate, of the Federal District Court in Manhattan, told Mr. Weiner that his offense was a serious crime that deserved punishment. He must surrender by November 6th, also has to pay $10,000, and has to register as a sex offender. So while a lot of people are talking about how he's got a problem, and obviously he does have a problem, he's also a predator, Jim. And when predators get caught, they get sentenced to prison. Republican, Democrat, Independent, doesn't matter. He's a danger to society, and he needs to be off the street.
You know, Greg, I regret to inform you that my right hand has shook the hand of Anthony Weiner. This was back, I'm going to say, summer of 2014. I'm on the promotional tour for the Weed Agency, and the one time I've ever done Bill Maher's program. And Anthony Weiner was one of the other guests. And I remember this is, I believe, I want to say it was after the first one. I don't know if it was the second round after he had, you know, decided to run for mayor of New York and insisted that he had changed and all that stuff. And I remember just thinking, oh, God, this is the most repulsive human being I've ever met. But what's more was that he felt the need to be out doing the Bill Maher show. That he had, I believe he had, you know, at that point he was writing a column for somebody, he was doing sports, or, you know, he was doing, but in other words, like he had just been through one of the most humiliating things a human being could go through, but he still felt the need to go out and be in the public eye. And I remember thinking, like, that's a really sad state to be in, that he couldn't just go off and be a lawyer, he couldn't try to live his life despite his terrible decisions. He still had Huma, he still had his child, he still, you know, Anthony Weiner could have gone on to live a normal life, but he still had to be a celebrity. And he decides to run for mayor again. He gets caught doing the exact same thing he was doing before. And I remember the exchange as he was resigning from the mayoral race. And he said something like, somebody asked him, do you know if everybody you were chatting with was above the age of 18? And he said something like, well, I guess so. I think so. And I remember thinking, ugh, that's, you know, like I, again, you, I guess, suppose if you're chatting with somebody anonymously, you don't know that. But all of a sudden, this went from being a creepy guy sending texts or sending, you know, chat messages to somebody to a, I think, you know, crossing a moral line that absolutely everybody would, you know, recoil in horror from. You know, it's worth noting, you know, it's common to joke, this is what happens when your marriage is presided over by Bill Clinton. You know, being a womanizer, it's bad behavior, but it's not a crime, right? If Anthony Weiner had just gone out and slept with everybody he could try to do it, like Huma would be unhappy, lots of people would be unhappy with him, but he would not be going to prison. There was something about Anthony Weiner that, like, even garden variety womanizing was not enough for this guy. There's something really, really wrong with him. So then the audacity to then say, you know, the prosecutors are skeptical that I have truly changed and I don't blame them. I repeatedly acted in an obviously destructive way when I got caught. Look, you know, you can't be the boy who cried wolf. You know, this is a great irony since I believe he denied to Wolf that this was his those were his underwear in the texts that were sent. Anthony Weiner, you know, he got, you know, second chance and third chance and fourth chance. And there were just a wide sense of people who just like, just go away, stop doing this. Allegedly, remember, he was in therapy and all kinds of stuff. There's no indication that any of this took with this guy. So now he's going to jail. And for all the times we have seen elected officials and lawmakers and retired lawmakers do something very unethical and get let off with a slap on the wrist, that did not happen in this case. This is one of the cases where I feel like, you know, if there's anything good coming out of this to qualify this as the good martini, is that, look, this was the judge said, this is a serious crime that deserves serious punishment, and he's getting serious punishment. And that as much as, look, mental illness is a really difficult challenge for people to deal with, you know, this idea that, oh, he's got a disease of sexual compulsivity, some call it sex addiction. At some point, you have to be held accountable for your actions. You can't say, oh, my compulsions made me do it. The devil made me do it. At some point, you have to be held responsible for what you choose to do. And finally, that has occurred here. And, you know, you only hope that his child and Huma and everybody else is able to go on and live a better, happier life after this experience, and that we never hear the name Anthony Weiner ever again.
Not that we need a kicker to a story like this, but the local ABC station here in Washington is quoting a website called The Blast, which I've never heard of. But this is what will happen when Weiner goes to prison. The reports, Weiner will not be allowed to display nude or provocative photos, calendars, or pinups in his cell, but the minimum security facility reportedly allows inmates access to computers for 15 minutes a day.
Boy, what can you do with that?
That ought to rehabilitate him. All right, let's move on to the bad martini now, Jim. And in the "this is why we can't have nice things" department, let's talk about the Republicans and their approach to health care reform here. It's obviously been a struggle. We were hoping they'd have an idea of what they wanted to do 7 years after Obamacare passed. And in the now, what are we at, 8 months since the Trump administration began. But no, Graham Cassidy is effectively dead. We now have 4 Republican no votes. Yesterday we talked about Rand Paul, who thinks that it's still too much like Obamacare, John McCain, who won't vote for it because it didn't have a bipartisan regular order approach. Now we've got 2 more, one on each side, one who thinks it's not conservative enough and one who thinks it doesn't do enough. From Politico, Ted Cruz saying that he can't support it. He says that he and Mike Lee offered amendments to the Graham Cassidy proposal last week that would go further in bringing down Obamacare premiums, but the changes, he said, weren't included in the latest draft of the bill. Cruz and Senator John Cornyn, also of Texas, said they backed the way the bill would convert Obamacare funding into a system of block grants to the states. But while Cornyn said he would vote for the bill as it stands, Cruz said he wants to see more changes, though he did not elaborate on what those changes needed to be. As for Collins, in a statement, she said the bill does not go far enough to protect people with pre-existing conditions and that the proposal's cuts to Medicaid are too steep. Quote, sweeping reforms to our healthcare system and to Medicaid can't be done well in a compressed time frame, especially when the actual bill is a moving target. She says the bill would also open the door for states to weaken protections for people with pre-existing conditions such as asthma, cancer, heart disease, arthritis, and diabetes. So, Jim, we sent Republicans to Congress for 4 consecutive election cycles to do something about this. And now, after having the deck stacked in our favor here, it reminds me of the old line from Office Space. What is it that you'd say you do here?
Well, the only qualified point I would make is that, so we've got 48 senators who voted twice to repeal and replace. The House passed its version back earlier in the spring. They got their job done. It is these 4 who, 3 before and then 4 this time, who have, you know, basically said, look, this isn't the ideal repeal and replace. We have this idea of a theoretical one that would be just so much better than that, that we cannot accept this, even though it does a lot of things the conservatives like. It would move to, you know, greater flexibility for states, block grants, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, guys, Collins, Murkowski, McCain, I want to see your version. You guys say you want to repeal and replace Obamacare. I want to see, since you guys have been the ones that have been the stumbling block, you have been the roadblock, you have been the ones saying, no, this isn't good enough, this doesn't meet my standards. All right, guys, show us what does, you know, do your standards, because we've gotten almost everybody else in the Republican Party to unite around not just this particular piece of legislation, but the American Health Care Act before that, and a whole bunch of different ideas. There are a lot of Republicans who want, I want to say vote for anything, but who vote for anything that moves the ball in the right direction. And at some point you have to say, you know what, you know, all right, this isn't going to solve every problem. It doesn't have selling insurance across state lines the way we want. It doesn't have tort reform the way we want. But it makes things better, so we're going to try to do that. And it'd be, you know, the frustration is palpable, understandable, justifiable. If people really feel betrayed, that is understandable. They're not going to, you know, Murkowski's not going to face until 2022. I think it's pretty, you know, looking at the actuarial tables, it's very likely John McCain has had his last election. And Collins would, you know, it would be a while before she, you know, faces the voters again. They basically, there is no chance for disgruntled conservatives to really be able to, you know, make them pay for oppose, you know, for not just blocking their promise to replace Obamacare. Because they always say how much they want to replace Obamacare, but no replacement is ever good enough for them to do that, which comes across as a suspicious comfort with the level of with the status quo, with the way things are going. And probably out of these, I think the one I find most cynical is probably Rand Paul, whose state is undoubtedly benefiting from the expansion of Medicaid and a lot of people in that state. My guess is there are a lot of people in Kentucky who really would, you know, so plenty of Kentucky Republicans who kind of know that if they actually did undo that, if certain people lost the insurance or Medicaid that they have, they'd be really angry at Rand Paul. But by taking this position, no, I refuse to, this isn't good enough. This doesn't go far enough. That's why I'm designed to keep things exactly the way they are. Our party, so many people in our party, either earnestly or cynically claim to want the perfect and to want, you know, who refuse to agree to baby steps, refuse to agree for incremental improvements. And as a result of that, we don't move the ball forward at all. And it's utterly, utterly, these are the times when the angry anti-incumbent mood makes a lot of sense, Greg.
It certainly does. And of course, getting this repeal or repair or reform done was critical to setting the stage for tax reform. So how optimistic are you that that's going to happen now?
You know, you'd like to think that, you know, other items on the Republican agenda, tax reform, stuff like that would unite Republicans. But look, you know, if you can't unite Republicans on repealing and replacing Obamacare after they've been promising for so long, What do we all stand for? What do we all agree on? It's a fair question, I suspect.
Optimism not high, but hopefully it's a different story on tax reform. We'll see. Let's move on to the crazy martini now, and blissfully only one story on the NFL and the national anthem today, and it would have been none if it not for this story. We talked yesterday about how the Steelers did not exit the locker room. In fact, they voted as a team by a narrow majority to stay in the locker room during the anthem in order to promote team unity. Well, as we mentioned yesterday, Alejandra Villanueva, a U.S. Army Ranger veteran who served three tours in Afghanistan, felt that as a veteran, and he had a lot of vets contacting him, telling him that he needed to be out there. And so he told team leaders that he was going to be out there. Apparently, he got permission from somebody to do it. And then the rest of the team was in the tunnel and can't be seen in the picture. And so he says because he didn't mention it to the rest of the team that he made the rest of the team and the rest of the organization look bad in all of this. Here's an extended excerpt of Villanueva's press conference back in Pittsburgh.
That is the very embarrassing part on my end and what transpires, because when everybody sees an image of me standing by myself, everybody thinks that the team and the Steelers are not behind me, and that's absolutely wrong. It's quite the opposite, as they all would have, actually the entire team would have been out there with me. Even the ones that wanted to take a knee would have been there with me had they known these extreme circumstances that at Soldier Field, you know, at the heat of the moment when I got soldiers, wounded veterans texting me that, you know, that I have to be out there, then I think everything would have been put aside from every single one of my teammates, no doubt. So because of that, I've made Coach Tomlin look bad, and that is my fault, and that is my fault only. I've made my teammates look bad, and that is my fault only. And I made the Steelers also look bad, and that is my fault and my fault only. So unwillingly, I've made a mistake.
Jim, it's not his fault that the team looked bad. They're the ones that decided not to be out there in the first place. The only ones who have a gripe here, I think, are the people who voted to be out there in the first place and then stayed behind because that's what the team voted to do. What's your take here?
Greg, there was a interesting, I was listening to sports radio just as we were about to come on. There's an interesting question. Do you think he got grief in the locker room for taking the stance he did?
I hope not, but James Harrison, I know, wasn't happy with it.
It's the sort of thing we would not have imagined it. But do you go out and make a statement like that saying, hey, my decision to go out has been misinterpreted and I didn't want to make my team look bad. Do you go out and do that if nobody on the if everyone else on the team is fine with what you did?
No, or management, yeah.
Right? I mean the implication there, you would have said if anybody, you know, would have nothing to apologize for, if anybody in the world would have a perspective that everybody would understand and respect and not give him any grief about, it is this one. Now, we talked about this yesterday, and a couple people on Twitter responded and said, look, Jim, I don't think Tomlin was angry at Villanueva. The decision of the Steelers to not come out during the national anthem was actually an attempt to sidestep the entire controversy. They didn't want to be seen as some people standing and some people kneeling, so they just weren't going to be there. I don't know if that was the right call. I don't know if that's the right decision, but I can completely understand any coach or anybody in the NFL saying, I really don't want to deal with this, right? I want to, you know, I don't understand why every decision of what, if you stand, all of a sudden you're rebuking your teammate who has chosen to take a knee. If you take a knee in form of protest, suddenly you are somehow unpatriotic or you don't like the country or you hate cops or something like that. That all of a sudden, a lot of guys who don't deal with politics have had politics thrust upon them. And if that's what was frustrating Tomlin so much, I guess I understand. I don't think that you know, obviously it did not work. Another interesting point, by the way, Greg, is that we talked about a bit about this yesterday. If Kaepernick had been signed and was a backup somewhere, in the offseason, he had said he was going to stand this year. That he felt like he had made his point, he'd proved his point, and that to continue doing this would be counterproductive. So in a great irony, each step which could have kind of diffused this, right? That if he had been signed, that he would probably be standing right now, and I assume you would not see nearly as many players taking a knee. When it happened in the preseason with the Cleveland Browns, I actually don't think that was a terribly high-profile event. What really turned, you know, threw gasoline on this fire was Trump's statement in Alabama on Friday night. The controversy had kind of calmed down, and now it's raging even more. And now even Villanueva feels like by going out and standing for the national anthem, somehow he's done something wrong, and somehow he's done something that is seen as a betrayal of the rest of his teammates and his coach or something like that. And I thought it was really weird that he himself had to feel he had to come out. Like, why the other 45 guys weren't coming out and saying it? And the other weird thing is that Ben Roethlisberger issued a statement basically saying he regretted the stance. Now, again, I don't think it is a – I understand coaches want unity on their team. Coaches want every single player feeling like they will, you know – they will take the hit for the next guy on that, you know, when there's a rushing defender in order to make sure the quarterback can make that. They need to feel unified. They need to feel like they're working as one unit. But I don't think that trying to get your team to all react the same way to this controversy is going to work. And I think that's what the Steelers tried. I think it has kind of backfired on them. I would not have figured the Steelers would end up becoming the most controversial team in the league after this time. Somewhere Pete Carroll said in the thing, like, wait, how did I avoid this?
No, I think they realized that they look bad. Maybe there was some awkwardness and some confusion based on what he said here about how maybe there was an effort to change the decision right there at the last second when he decided to go out. But ultimately, the Steelers made a decision that was grossly unpopular, not only with the fans at Soldier Field, but also with a lot of the Pittsburgh Steeler fan base. And now the solution here is to potentially throw him under the bus. So whether he did this of his own volition or was compelled to do it, I'm not sure. But to make him the villain here is ridiculous.
Yeah, I also kind of don't get, like, let's say you've got, you know, your 53 guys. Apparently, you know, a lot of teams decided to have a vote. Well, if I'm on the winning, if I'm on the winning end of the vote, I don't know if I want to, like, if I would not take a knee. But I don't know if I'd feel comfortable telling my teammate, you can't take a knee. Right? I mean, it's not really what the First Amendment is about.
Right.
I think that stance is counterproductive and can be too easily interpreted the wrong way and alienates people who might otherwise be willing to listen and stuff like that. But I'm not going to tell somebody, well, you can't do that, right? So in a way, trying to collectivize the decision kind of steps on everybody's individual conscience. You know, Colin Kaepernick may be a schmo who doesn't really know about what Fidel Castro's real record is and thinks it's funny to wear cops as pig socks and stuff like that. But you're free to be a schmo in this country, right? You're free to be wrong. If you're not free to be wrong, then you don't really have freedom in this country if you're willing to take the consequence for it. And the consequence for it should be booing and should be counter-arguments. I'm not sure being, you know, effectively blacklisted for the rest of your career is the right response to this. But anyway, that's where we are. It's another terrible day in the NFL. But it's not that bad because, hey, Jets and Bears still won.
Jim, happy Tuesday. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.